Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Reed, and this is the Midland Reporter Telegram Weekend Edition for Saturday, September 21st, 2024. Midland unemployment steady at 2.8%. Midland saw a jump in both labor force and non-farm jobs in August, according to the Texas Workforce Commission. The commission said Friday the unemployment rate in its Midland Metropolitan Statistical Area, MSA, which includes Midland and Martin counties, held at 2.8% for a second month and is just above the 2.7% seen last August. Midland continues to see the state's lowest unemployment, followed by Amarillo at 3.4% and College Station Bryan at 3.6%. Odessa inched up to 3.9% from 3.8% in July. Quote, "We're really holding steady," end quote, said Willie Taylor, chief executive officer of the Commission's Workforce Solutions Permian Basin office, told the Reporter Telegram. Quote, "We'll see how the third quarter runs, but it looks like we'll maintain a steady pace," end quote. Taylor said the region continues to see demand for critical skills, including education, health care, law enforcement, commercial driver's license holders. And with baby boomers increasingly retiring, he predicted, quote, "It will be a continuous tight workforce," end quote. "The good thing is," he said, adding that all the training programs at local schools are full. Quote, "We just need to make sure they choose the right occupations," end quote. Looking at the 17-county region he oversees, Taylor said, quote, "I'm so proud of this region. We came out of the pandemic so quickly, and now we're back to pre-pandemic levels," end quote. Midland's civilian labor force rose to 117,921 from 117,253 in July, and is well above the 115,332 reported last August. Of that, 114,567 are employed Midlanders, up from 113,998 in July and 112,269 last August. The number of unemployed Midlanders also rose, however, to 3,354 from 3,255 in July and from 3,063 a year earlier. Midland added 900 jobs from July to August for a total non-farm job count of 122,400. Mining, logging, and construction dominated by gaining 700 jobs over the month. The financial activities sector, private education and health services sector, and government sector each added 100 jobs. Trade, transportation, and utilities was the only sector to post a loss, down 100 jobs over the month. Over the 12 months from August 2023 to August 2024, Midland has added 1,800 jobs for a growth rate of 1.5%. Private education and health services jumped by 1,100 jobs. The mining, logging, and construction sector, trade, transportation, and utility sector, and financial activity sector each added 300 jobs. The government sector added 200 jobs, and the manufacturing sector added 100 jobs. The professional and business services sector and leisure and hospitality sector each lost 200 jobs over the year, and the information sector was down 100 jobs. Statewide, the unemployment rate was 4.1% as the labor market continued to set records for jobs and civilian labor force. Texas seasonally adjusted total non-farm employment increased to 14,239,200 after 78,000 jobs were added over the month. Texas seasonally adjusted civilian labor force achieved a new record high of 15,398,400 after adding 44,800 people over the month. While Midland reported the lowest unemployment, the highest was in McAllen, Edinburgh, Mission at 6.4%. MISD police to purchase new vehicles. Hiring surge creates need for more equipment. The Midland ISD Police Department has been hiring more officers to join their team, which has created a need for more equipment. According to the district, the MISD Police Department needs 12 additional vehicles.
including 9 campus patrol vehicles, 2 access control vehicles, and a vehicle for the chief of police. At Tuesday's regular board meeting, trustees unanimously approved the request to purchase 12 additional vehicles for the MISD Police Department. Quote, "We're hiring officers now, and being able to equip them with a vehicle allows them to respond to any emergency calls for service," end quote, said Chief of Police Scott McCown. Quote, "It allows them to work traffic around the campuses and will allow them to transport subjects that they've arrested to either the county or to the youth center," end quote. Last year, Texas passed House Bill 3. It's the 88th legislative session, requiring an armed security guard to be present on all school campuses. To meet that requirement, MISD has been hiring more officers. Quote, "Our hiring is going well," end quote, McCown said. Quote, "We're now to the point that we'll have an officer assigned to every campus. Some officers will be assigned to 2 elementary campuses," end quote. He added that the district can now provide officers with the necessary equipment they need to perform their job every day and keep students and staff safe. The district recommended purchasing 9 Interceptor Utility Explorer vehicles from Sewell Family of Companies for a total estimated cost of $615,683. They also recommended purchasing 1 Ford F-150 and 1 Ford Maverick from Rogers Ford for approximately $44,697 and $33,217, respectively, to use as access control vehicles. The district also recommended purchasing the chief of police vehicle, an Ford Expedition, from Rogers Ford for approximately $54,540. The total estimated cost of the 12 vehicles would be $748,137. The purchase of the vehicles is not a part of the board-approved budget and would require a budget amendment to utilize fund balance for the one-time purchase. Chief Financial Officer Tucker Durham said that using fund balances for one-time expenditures is a good use of the fund balance because it's not an ongoing expense. Prior to the approval of the purchase, Board President Tommy Bishop asked what the turnaround on receiving the vehicles would be. Durham said that based on the bid documents, the turnaround time was 60 days for the Sewell Family Company's vehicles and 10 days for the Rogers Ford vehicles. Quote, "It's awesome that we can equip our officers with the equipment they need," end quote, McCown said. Quote, "We're very grateful of the support that the school district and the Midland community provide to our department," end quote. Pflugerr Congress vote to oust EPA rule. The Environmental Protection Agency's rule to curb vehicle emissions hit a roadblock in the U.S. House of Representatives on Friday. Congress voted 215 to 191, largely along party lines, to provide disapproval for the EPA's rule on stricter emission standards for light-duty and medium-duty motor vehicles. The rule, which went into effect June 17th, targeted model years 2027 through 2032 and aimed to push for the manufacture of more vehicles with advanced emission control technologies, including electric vehicles, hybrid electric vehicles, and plug-in hybrid electric vehicles, as well as cars and trucks with, quote, advanced gasoline vehicle technologies, end quote. Congressman August Pflugerr, Representative Republican 11, who represents Midland, voted in favor of ousting the EPA's new rule and is one of the resolution's 129 co-sponsors. Quote, "This is something I've been working on for several years," end quote, Pflugerr told the Reporter Telegram. He said the EPA rule was one that, quote, "Congress did not intend that was mandated to the American public," end quote. The congressman especially took issue with what he said was a lack of planning. Quote, "This mandate doesn't take into account the electricity demand we would need to power all of these electric vehicles," end quote, Pflugerr said. Quote, "I asked Department of Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm about this. She couldn't tell me how much electricity we currently use and how much she predicts would be needed to make this mandate work," end quote. Pflugerr also cited concerns that the rule would raise costs for Americans, particularly for farmers, ranchers, and small business owners that rely on the gasoline and diesel-powered vehicles. Quote, "It's an all-out assault on the Permian Basin," end quote, he said. Senate Joint Resolution 75, which is the companion to H.J.R. 136, is up next in the Democratic-led Senate. A vote has not yet been scheduled. Senators Ted Cruz and John Cornyn, who represent Texas, are co-sponsors. Fundraiser planned for Texas DPS trooper. Kevin Ramirez Vasquez in critical condition after being struck by a vehicle. Ector County. While Texas Department of Public Safety trooper Kevin Ramirez Vasquez is fighting for his life inside a Lubbock hospital, local efforts are already underway to host a fundraiser for him and his family. A U.S. Army veteran and recent graduate of DPS Class A-23, Vasquez was struck by a vehicle at approximately 9 a.m. Tuesday while outside of his patrol vehicle. He was investigating a crash along State Highway 302 near mile marker 246 in Ector County. Quote, it is still life-threatening. And he is listed as being in critical condition, end quote, said Odessa Police Sergeant John Faust. Faust added that the local fundraiser is put together by the officers of the Odessa Police Department, and the effort is, quote, all in the name of taking care of our brothers in blue, end quote. The fundraiser is 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Thursday, October 10th, in Barn A at the Ector County Coliseum. As of now, the effort to plan the fundraiser and collect donations is a community-wide effort. Quote, we expect that Ector County ISD will send out volunteers to help prepare the food, end quote, Faust said regarding the fundraiser. Quote, but we are still in the planning stages. We are accepting donations for the water, the chips, and the cookies, end quote. The fundraiser plans to sell hamburger plates with chips, a cookie, and water for $10 per plate. Quote, we want all the proceeds to go directly to him, Vasquez, and his family, end quote, Faust said. Quote, that's why we are asking for donations for the food and other supplies needed for the plate sale, end quote. Faust said they expect to sell at least 2,500 tickets. Quote, they can go to the Odessa Police Department and pick up tickets after Tuesday, end quote, he said. Quote, as far as planning, get your tickets early, end quote. The Odessa Police fundraising effort is still asking for donations such as plates, napkins, and other miscellaneous supplies. Additionally, DPS Sergeant Stephen Blanco confirmed there is a DPS fund also taking donations for Vasquez. The Texas DPS Officers Troopers Foundation has launched a Help a Hero fundraiser to support the Vasquez family. Quote, these kinds of accidents happen far too frequently, end quote, Faust said. Quote, driver noncompliance on crash scenes where we see a lot of reckless drivers when we are trying to work a crash, end quote. Faust added that police need drivers to pay attention to the road, especially while officers are directing traffic at a crash site. City focusing on resident experience transparency. The City of Midland has made resident experience a priority, and in recent months has launched a pair of applications aimed at making customer service easier on residents. The city is also taking action on increasing transparency. In July, the city formally announced the addition of See, Click, Fix, and Ask Jackie to its services. There's also Alert Midland, the city's emergency alert system that provides notifications for weather emergencies, road closures, missing persons, and evacuations. Quote, a city is only as good as the customer service it provides to its residents, end quote, District 4 Councilwoman Amy Stretcher Burks told the Reporter-Telegram this week. Quote, that's been extremely important to me and the rest of City Council. Burks isn't just a promoter, she uses the service herself. Boots on the ground. See, Click, Fix allows residents to report non-emergency issues they see around the city, such as broken streetlights, graffiti, broken parks equipment, and the need for large item pickups. Quote, I've used the See, Click, Fix app quite a few times, actually, end quote, she said. Quote, I've reported potholes around the city, and I made my submissions anonymously. They were all fixed within 48 hours, end quote. The Ask Jackie test. Chief of Staff Taylor Novak told City Council in July that more than 150 employees had received intensive customer service training and that the city is trying to eliminate the time-consuming and annoying practice of phone transfers for resident questions. With the implementation of Ask Jackie, the city hopes to reduce the need for phone calls even further.
Ask Jackie, the AI virtual assistant found on the city's website, is intended to provide answers to common questions easily. On Friday, the Reporter Telegram asked Jackie several questions a resident might ask. How do I pay my water bill? How do I schedule a large item pickup? What is the city sales tax rate? What does the city spend the most money on? When is the next city council meeting? How can I watch city council meetings online? Who is my city councilman? Who is Jack Ladd? Ask Jackie either gave or linked to correct information every time. And Jack Ladd is the councilman for District 3. Quote, I think Ask Jackie is great, and the more people use it, the better it gets at answering accurately, end quote, Burke said. Efforts to be more transparent. The City of Midland said it is raising the bar for transparency in Midland. Part of its plan is, quote, providing communication with Spanish language content that will allow more residents the opportunity to know what is taking place in their community, end quote, a news release from the city said. Other efforts include making it easier to access presentation materials provided to City Council during meetings and being clear about how the city spends taxpayer money. Quote, the City of Midland has long set the standard in our community for transparency, end quote, the release said. Quote, residents can go online before every meeting and see the exact same information packet that council members receive. Now your city is ready to up its game when it comes to responsiveness and providing even more information, end quote. Crude prices rise above $70, supported by Fed rate cut, lower U.S. oil supplies. Crude prices rose past the $70 mark this week, supported by a large interest rate cut from the Federal Reserve and a dip in U.S. oil supplies, posting a second consecutive weekly gain. West Texas Intermediate rose 3 of 5 trading days on the New York Mercantile Exchange, opening the trading week with a $1.44 gain that pushed prices above $70. Prices neared $72 Thursday with a $1.04 gain, then dipped 3 cents to end the week at $71.92, better than 4% weekly gain and up from $68.65 at last Friday's close. The posted price closed at $68.40, according to Plains All American. A storm system headed for the Gulf of Mexico helped send natural gas prices higher, with futures rising 3 of 5 trading days on the NYMEX. The week's trading was highlighted by Friday's 9-cent jump that sent prices to $2.436 per MCF, up from $2.297 at last Friday's report. Phil Flynn, author of The Energy Report, wrote that the Federal Reserve's rate-cutting cycles have eventually always led to higher oil prices. Quote, the reasons for that are clear, end quote, he wrote. Quote, the Fed cuts rates and the dollar weakens, and that pushes up oil prices. The cost of carry for oil and gas producers because of lower interest rates is less, so producers can produce less oil and gas and make more money. That situation should reduce production a bit as many producers look to improve margins and costs, end quote. He continued, quote, now that does not mean they will not produce more as prices go up, but it will be more from a position of strength, not one of being forced to keep up cash flow. And while prices may be subject to short-term technical situations like becoming overbought or even oversold, the reality is that when the Fed cuts rates, it changes the fundamentals, and historically it's always proven to be bullish over time, if not immediately, end quote. California man pleads guilty to $3 million wire fraud in Midland. A California man on Friday pleaded guilty in a Midland federal court to 2 counts of wire fraud totaling more than $3 million. According to court documents, Mitchell Vaughn Lee of Los Angeles acquired and utilized the personal identifying information of a mineral rights owner to access the victim's royalty account with Diamondback Energy. Lee's plan resulted in diverting royalty payments from bank accounts that were owned by the victim to a bank account controlled by Lee. According to a press statement from the U.S. Attorney General's office, there were at least 2 occasions in February 2022 when Lee worked to divert approximately $1.5 million from the victim's oil royalty account to a bank account in Lee's control.
quote, in February 2022, law enforcement agents executed a search warrant at Lee's Los Angeles residence, end quote, the press statement said. In addition to other items recovered during the execution of the February 2022 search warrant, agents also recovered a firearm and a direct deposit change form for Diamondback Energy with the victim's name and unique non-public owner identification number for the victim's Diamondback Energy oil royalty account. Within California, Lee was initially prosecuted for felon in possession of a firearm. However, while Lee was awaiting trial, he absconded. In 2023, he was later located in Miami by federal agents. Lee was sentenced to 60 years imprisonment within the Central District of California for felony firearms possession. For the Texas wire fraud case, Lee faces up to an additional 20 years in prison for each count. A federal district judge will determine his sentence while Lee remains in custody awaiting proceedings. U.S. Attorney Jaime Esparza from the Western District of Texas made the announcement. The FBI is investigating the case. Assistant U.S. Attorney Joe Mahoney is prosecuting the case.
U.S. rig count falls for fifth week. Texas and Permian Basin see increases. Drilling activity returned to a decline after drillers gave back some of the last week's eight-rig surge. Oilfield Services company Baker Hughes said Friday its U.S. rig count was down two rigs to 588, falling for a fifth week out of six. The count is 42 rigs, or 7% below the 630 reported last year. After jumping by five last week, the number of rigs drilling for crude oil remained at 488 rigs, down 19 from 507 a year ago. The number of rigs drilling for natural gas fell 1 to 96 after last week's three-rig gain. That's down 22 rigs from 118 rigs drilling for natural gas last year. Texas bucked the national trend by adding two rigs for 276 rigs at work across the state, down 36 rigs from 312 a year ago. New Mexico was down one rig to 106. Texas was the only producing state to see an increase. Colorado 1, Louisiana 1, and Utah 1 joined New Mexico as producing states to see declines. Like Texas, the Permian Basin bucked the national trend by adding a rig for 307 rigs active across the region. That's down 10 rigs from 317 last year. And like Texas, the Permian was the only major producing basin to see an increase. Lee County, New Mexico, remains the most active county in the Permian with 52 rigs, down one for the week. Eddy County, New Mexico, is close behind, reporting 50 rigs for a second week. Martin County reported 32 rigs for a third consecutive week, while Reeves County had 29 rigs at work within county lines for a third consecutive week. Midland County added a rig to have 24 rigs. Loving County saw 19 rigs for a second week. Reagan and Upton counties each continued to report 14 rigs, and Howard County added a rig for 10 rigs for the week. Energy Dedicated Software as a Service firm in Veris said its U.S. rig count for the week ended September 13th rose five rigs to 633, 49 rigs, or 7% below the 682 reported last year. The number of rigs drilling for oil rose by three rigs to 193, still 222 rigs, or 53%, the 415 rigs drilling for crude last year. The number of rigs drilling for natural gas jumped by seven rigs to 99, but remains 58 rigs, or 37% below the 157 drilling for natural gas last year. ExxonMobil remains atop the list of top 10 most active operators by rig count with 40 rigs, up one for the week ended September 13th. ConocoPhillips stayed in second with 29 rigs, down one for the week, and Occidental Petroleum remains in third with 25 rigs, unchanged for the week. Enverus said its Permian Basin rig count for the week ended September 13th rose by four rigs to 305 rigs, 24 rigs, or 7% below the 329 counted last year. The Delaware Basin, the most active play, rose four rigs to 174 rigs, five rigs, or 3% below the 179 counted last year. the second most active play. The Midland Basin was down one rig to 113 rigs and is 11 rigs or 9% below the 124 rigs active in the region a year ago. In terms of trailing 30-day drilling permits, the Permian reported 817 permits as of the week ended August 30th, down from 845 the previous week, but well above the 713 reported last year. The Permian had 102 frac crews at work during the week ended August 30th, down from 115 the previous week and 135 a year earlier. Two dead in Martin County crash involving semi-truck and Jeep. Martin County. A two-vehicle collision has claimed the lives of two young adults. The collision occurred at approximately 1:45 p.m. Thursday along State Highway 349, mile marker 300. According to the Texas Department of Public Safety, 19-year-old Shelby Carroll of Huffman and 22-year-old Lauren Parks of Paducah were both pronounced dead at the scene of the incident by Judge Gerald Hedrick. Preliminary information from a DPS report revealed that a 2009 Freightliner semi-truck with trailer was traveling northbound on SH-349 near mile marker 300. The semi-truck was stopped in the inside lane, preparing to turn west into a private drive. The second vehicle, a 2012 Jeep Wrangler, traveled northbound on SH-349 in the inside lane and struck the semi-truck trailer from the rear. Both the driver and the passenger of the Jeep were pronounced deceased at the scene. This crash remains under investigation and no further information has been released to the public. Life tributes. Donna Roby Gatlin, 11-6-1946 to 9-17-2024. Donna Roby Gatlin of Midland, Texas, died Tuesday, September 17, 2024. Donna was born November 6, 1946 in Midland, Texas, to Coretta and Leonard Roby. Donna is preceded in death by her parents, Coretta and Leonard Roby, and brother, Kenneth Roby. Donna is survived by her husband, Dickie Gatlin, son, John Gatlin, and wife, Michelle, of Summit, North Carolina, daughter, Deborah Smith, and husband, Chad, of Azle, Texas, daughter, Melissa Clayton, and husband, Garrick, of Midland, Texas, grandchildren, Jordan Aris, wife, Iris, and children, Alvaro and Belle, Jared Aris, wife, Cambry, and daughter, Hazel Lynn, Jojo, Hannah Gatlin and baby girl on the way, Alyssa Clayton and son, Corbin, Jordan Clayton, wife, Mackenzie, and children, Caden, McKinley, and Maisley, Taylor Bell, Josh Snyder, Jeff Snyder, McCalla Snyder, and Jake Snyder, and numerous nieces and nephews. Funeral services have been scheduled for 10 o'clock a.m. Monday, September 23rd, 2024, at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home Chapel. Interment will follow at Rest Haven Memorial Park Cemetery. Pallbearers will be John Gatlin, Jordan Aris, Jared Aris, Garrick Clayton, Chad Smith, and Don Cheney. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory in Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Emma Sarkis, 11-14-1961 to 9-10-2024. Midland. Emma Z. Sarkis, 62, of Midland, Texas, passed away on Tuesday, September 10, 2024, in Midland. Emma was born in Odessa, Texas, to Blas and Francisca Zuniga on November 14, 1961, and attended school in Midland. Emma was preceded in death by her parents and half-brothers Santiago Zuniga and Antonio Zuniga. Emma is survived by her husband Mark Sarkis, son Timothy Martinez, and lifelong companion Alina Tarango, daughter Andrea Sarkis Ritter and her husband Thomas, brother Rick Zuniga and his wife Zee, sister Abigail Miles and her husband Lance, and their son Jack Miles, seven grandchildren, Logan Ritter, Andrew Ritter, Grace Ritter Fries, Olivia Ritter, Lucas Ritter, Rhett Ritter, and Daniel Martinez, and one great-grandchild, Jensen Fries. A celebration of Emma's life will be held at 3 o'clock p.m. on Friday, September 27th, 2024, at Willowbrook Funeral Home Chapel, 1311 West Florida Avenue, Midland, Texas, with Pastor Woodrow Bailey, Jr. of Macedonia Baptist Church officiating. Family requests in lieu of flowers to kindly donate to either the Alzheimer's Association or Hospice of Midland. Prisciliano Rivera. Prisciliano Rivera, age 101, of Midland, Texas, passed away on Wednesday, September 18, 2024. The family will receive friends for visitation Monday, September 23, 2024, from 4 to 8 p.m. at Ellis Funeral Home, with the rosary at 7 p.m. Mass will be celebrated on Tuesday, September 24th at 10 a.m. at Our Lady of Guadalupe Catholic Church, followed by a graveside committal with military honors at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Please visit ellisfunerals.com to leave online condolences. Oil Report. Luis Bays speaks at West Texas Geological Society Luncheon. ConocoPhillips manager highlights global shale plays. Luis Bays took those attending the West Texas Geological Society's networking luncheon on a global tour of unconventional shale plays. The Permian Basin water manager for ConocoPhillips began with the Bowen Surat and Beetaloo basins in Australia. Then Bays moved north to China with its numerous unconventional plays across the country. Then it was on to the Middle East from Saudi Arabia to Oman to the United Arab Emirates. Finally, Bays took his audience to South America and Argentina's Vaca Muerta play that rivals the Permian Basin with 16 billion barrels of oil and 308 trillion cubic feet of natural gas seen as technically recoverable. The common thread among these destinations is the Permian Basin, Bays said. With his gift of great geology, operating excellence by industry, diverse supply chains, and a favorable commercial environment. There is also an excellent infrastructure of service provider, operators, and pipelines. Those gifts have allowed the industry to significantly increase production through innovation and export the knowledge gained through that innovation to the globe's other shale plays. Quote, in Saudi Arabia, you see Americans, you see Europeans providing operational excellence, end quote, he said. But the foundation of all the Permian Basin's energy gifts is its geoscientists, Bays said. He cited geoscientists' role in play-based evaluation, analysis, continuous learning, operating excellence, technical innovation, field trials, and design quality. Quote, we're constantly asking for more. One more core, one more analysis. We're constantly challenging ourselves, end quote, he said. Bays said those challenges include managing produced water and induced seismicity. Quote, we need to get back to basics, end quote, on seismicity, he said. Symposium offers Permian 101 lesson on shale production. Those attending the West Texas Geological Society's Fall Symposium were in for a Permian 101 lesson over a day and a half of presentations and poster sessions. Providing the first lesson was Tim McMahon, project manager of the Tide Oil Resource Assessment, TORA, consortium at the Bureau of Economic Geology, University of Texas at Austin. The oil industry veteran, whose experience includes 10 years at ConocoPhillips, told his audience it was about 2006 when U.S. shale production began coming online. But, McMahon noted, shale production in the U.S. has a 200-year history that dates back to the first commercial natural gas well in Fredonia, New York, in 1825. Since then, production of both shale oil and natural gas has spread to the Niobrara, to the Woodford, to the Hugoton Field on Kansas, to the Eagle Ford, Fort Worth, Barnett, to the Bakken. In 2002, Devon Energy first successfully hydraulically fractured a horizontal well in the Bakken, he said, and the practice has spread to other plays. The Arab oil embargo of 1973 that sent crude oil and gasoline prices climbing spurred research into shale and other unconventional resources, he noted. McMahon provided an overview of the various shale plays. From the Marcellus to the Woodford, found primarily in Oklahoma, but extending into the Permian Basin, from the Bakken of North Dakota and Montana to the Barnett in the Fort Worth Basin. What all of these areas have in common is the shales were deposited in semi-restricted basins with access to the open ocean and produce from brittle inner beds, according to McMahon. The Permian Basin seems to have especially benefited from those depositions, enjoying a lot of benches, from the Wolfcamp A, B, C, and D to the Bone Spring and Sprayberry. Less than a quarter of the oil in place in the Permian Basin is technically recoverable, not economically recoverable, though both being technically recoverable and economically recoverable are moving targets, he said. Approximately 75% of the nation's shale oil comes from Texas, and of that, 63% is from the Permian Basin. Approximately 40% of the nation's natural gas is associated with oil production, and 38% of that is from Texas. Of the Texas production, 23% comes from the Permian Basin. The share of the nation's oil production coming from unconventional resources surpassed conventional production in 2017 and now stands at more than 60%. Quote, shale has gone from a minor contributor to the dominant source due to technical innovations, end quote, said McMahon. Quote, the resources are significant, end quote. Explosion at Energy Transfer Pipeline prompts safety concerns. An explosion at an Energy Transfer natural gas liquids pipeline in the Houston suburbs of Deer Park and LaPorte has drawn the spotlight to issues of pipeline safety. The explosion occurred when an SUV hit an above-ground valve on the underground pipeline, causing the evacuation of nearly 1,000 homes at one point and schools to shelter in place. Quote, a pipeline company's highest priority is the safety of its crew, its assets, and the communities it serves. Pipelines are the safest, most reliable, efficient, and economic means of transporting natural gas, crude, and refined petroleum products, end quote. Thurr Cannon, president, Texas Pipeline Association, told the Reporter-Telegram. Quote, following an incident such as this, which is rare, the industry will always assess its systems. Texas' more than 489,000 miles of pipeline are vital to this nation's energy infrastructure as they continue to deliver the essential hydrocarbons that support our homes and businesses, end quote, he continued. Quote, there are regulations from 2022 aimed at reducing deaths, injuries, and environmental damage from pipeline ruptures, but these regulations apply to gas lines, not those carrying hazardous liquids, and do not apply to this pipeline, end quote. Kenneth Clarkson, communications director with Pipeline Safety Trust, a nonprofit that promotes pipeline safety through education and advocacy, told the Reporter-Telegram. Quote, the regulations issued in the spring of 2022 require pipeline companies to install emergency valves that can quickly shut off the flow of oil, natural gas, or other hazardous fuels when pipelines rupture. In this case, however, there was so much liquid in a 20-mile stretch of the pipeline between two closed valves that authorities and Energy Transfer had to wait several days for the fire to burn itself out before they could begin investigations or repair work. Quote, another issue from a safety perspective is that many new pipeline safety regulations do not apply retroactively to existing pipelines, end quote. Clarkson added. For example, he said the Pipeline and Hazardous Material Safety Administration enacted new rules on the types of valves and their locations, but those safety improvements only apply to new or replaced pipelines, not the existing pipeline involved in the explosion, he wrote. Quote, one of the biggest shortcomings is there are no federal regulations that govern the location of pipelines near homes and businesses. Those are often left to local zoning ordinances, which are terribly inconsistent at best, end quote, Clarkson wrote. The valve hit by the vehicle had been surrounded by chain-link fencing and topped with barbed wire. But Clarkson said operators can do more to prevent vehicles from damaging their infrastructure, and they have a public responsibility to do so. He recommended installing bollards or other protective equipment. Quote, we don't know enough about this particular piece of infrastructure to know what Energy Transfer did or did not do to protect the public. But obviously, it was not enough, end quote, he added. He went on to note that in 2022, the company had a similar pipeline fire, and according to Texas Railroad Commission data, the operator has already had 8 incidents in 2024. Quote, Energy Transfer needs to look at their safety culture and protect the people and the environment near their pipelines, end quote, Clarkson concluded. EIA finds low heat content in Texas natural gas. Permian Basin natural gas volumes have climbed alongside crude production, and operators are increasingly banking premiums, particularly for the ethane extracted from that natural gas. A recent report from the Energy Information Administration finds the natural gas liquids content of wet natural gas produced in the Permian Basin is among the highest nationwide. According to EIA analysts, the natural gas produced in association with crude oil in the Permian Basin's 3 largest plays has tripled since 2018. According to Trinity Manning Pickett, economist in the EIA's natural gas team, told the Reporter Telegram. Even so, the authors of the report note that the heat content of dry natural gas delivered to Texas consumers was among the lowest nationwide in 2023. Natural gas pipelines generally require heat content to be within a certain range to safely transport dry natural gas, and manufacturers of devices that use natural gas as fuel will design them to work within a certain range of heat content, Jordan Young, economist with the EIA's natural gas team, told the Reporter Telegram. The heat content of natural gas is a measure of how much energy is contained within the gas, how hot the gas burns. Wet natural gas is composed primarily of methane, but also contains ethane, propane, and other hydrocarbon gases, which have greater heat content than methane. Ethane, propane, and other hydrocarbon components are removed from the wet natural gas through cryogenic or other processes to create natural gas liquids. The reduced concentration of NGLs lowers the heat content of the resulting dry natural gas and allows for more methane volume to be safely transported at higher pressures via pipeline. With Texas operators facing pipeline takeaway capacity restraints, the recovery of more NGLs, particularly ethane, from the natural gas stream allows natural gas pipelines in the Permian to transport more methane. In addition, by removing more NGLs, especially ethane, producers are capitalizing on favorable differences between the price of natural gas and natural gas liquids. Ethane made up 44% of the NGL removed from the natural gas stream in the Permian Basin in 2023. And propane represented an additional 30%, according to the EIA. Once the natural gas meets pipeline quality standards, natural gas plant operators can choose to recover additional ethane from the natural gas stream when prices create a favorable premium. The ethane premium to natural gas has increased in recent years in response to growing demand in domestic and international petrochemical markets. Excluding the severe impact of Winter Storm Uri on natural gas prices in early 2021, the annual average ethane premium in the United States has risen every year since 2019 from 79 cents per million British thermal units, MMBTU, to $1.47 per MMBTU in 2023, according to data from Bloomberg and Natural Gas Intelligence. Pineapple on pizza, ketchup on steak, 7 food debates guaranteed to spark heated discussions. Don't deny it, you probably have a guilty pleasure when it comes to absurd food combos, like ketchup on steak, that you know will ruffle some feathers. Explore some of the most divisive food debates that are bound to spark intense arguments, whether it's about the best pasta shape or pineapple on pizza. Find out where you stand and how unique your taste preferences really are. Pineapple on pizza, a crime or delicious combo? The Hawaiian pizza made of ham and pineapple has been the center of debate since its creation. Fans argue that the sweetness of the pineapple perfectly complements the savory flavors of the ham and cheese.
Critics, however, claim that fruits should not be on pizza, as it isn't a traditional topping on authentic Italian pizza. The best part of pizza is that it's highly customizable to your taste. You can make it using Fathead Pizza Dough, a low-carb, gluten-free dough recipe for those looking for a healthier alternative, and top it with pineapples and ham or whatever you want. If you choose to embrace Hawaiian pizza, be ready to defend your decision. Can ketchup go on everything? Sure, ketchup and fries are a no-brainer combo, but what about ketchup on eggs or even steak? Ketchup fans believe this condiment goes well on anything, providing a sweet, tangy flavor that elevates the dish. Opponents argue that it's too overpowering and should be left to serve with fried or greasy food. Your tolerance for ketchup depends on whether you grew up eating it on practically everything, or if you just reserve the condiment for certain foods. Cilantro, a soapy disaster or essential herb? Cilantro is probably one of the most divided herbs, and believe it or not, it all comes down to your genes. To some, cilantro tastes like straight soap, and according to Flavor Journal, that's because their olfactory receptors, which allow you to recognize specific tastes and odors, have a genetic variation. This variant results in the aldehydes that make up cilantro to taste unpleasant. This common herb used in many cuisines may have a pleasing lemony and peppery taste to some, while others will find it revolting. What's the best pasta shape? There are hundreds of different pasta shapes you can buy, sparking debate on which is the superior one. Each shape has its own unique texture and sauce that works best with it. Spaghetti is undoubtedly the most popular type that has become the icon of Italian pasta. However, there are many more that contend for the first place spot. Radiatori is well loved for its thickness and ridges, which many believe make it perfect for pasta sauces. Conchigli, a shell-shaped pasta, is best for mac and cheese, making sure that each bite is packed with flavor and cheese. Those who have visited Tuscany destinations will surely argue that pappardelle, a long, flat pasta famous in Tuscany, is the best. If you find yourself in a debate about pasta shapes, prepare for a heated discussion with no resolution in sight. Does the order of the milk matter? Whether you put in milk first or after the cereal can change your eating experience substantially. It may seem like a trivial conversation to have during breakfast, but it will lead to an intense debate. On the one hand, cereal first allows you to pour just the right ratio of milk into your bowl. If you do almond milk first, the cereal just floats on top. However, fans of this method say that it prevents the cereal from getting soggy. By adding a bit every time, you get a bite of fresh and crunchy cereal with a spoonful of milk. It really comes down to how serious you are about your morning bowl of delight. Are the best cookies crispy or chewy? The warm, soft, and gooey cookie may be an irresistible treat for some, while others would trade it in a heartbeat for the satisfying crunch of a crispy cookie. Your preference would likely be influenced by what's considered the norm where you live. Traditional Swedish and Norwegian cookies are crispy and smaller than American cookies. The usage of the cookie can also sway your opinion. Perhaps you'd go for a drier cookie for dunking in tea and a soft cookie for any other occasion. The texture preference for cookies even leads to questions about how long the baking time should be and the golden ratio for ingredients. Everyone seems to have their own recipe to get the exact chewiness or crispiness of their ideal cookie. Is breakfast the most important meal of the day? Breakfast habits usually fall into two categories, those who need it to function in the morning and those who skip the meal entirely. Breakfast is often stated as the most important meal of the day as it can help you meet your daily nutrient intake and support healthy eating habits. A National Health and Nutrition Examination survey that evaluated American children found that breakfast eaters consumed less added sugar and more fiber, folate, iron, vitamin C, vitamin A, and calcium. Of course, what matters is the nutritious quality of your breakfast food. It makes a big difference if you're taking inspiration from a clean eating food list rather than consuming sugary cereals or fatty foods. However, breakfast skippers have a good argument as well. With intermittent fasting, you have to fast for a certain period of the day, which may mean you can't eat breakfast. Research in the New England Journal of Medicine shows that when done properly, intermittent fasting can burn fat and protect organs against diseases like type 2 diabetes and heart disease. Ultimately, your breakfast preference depends on your lifestyle choice and health goals. Food sparks passionate debates. With food being a necessity in life, it's hard not to be passionate about your preferences.
From the texture of cookies to the order of milk and cereals, everyone has a different ideal way of eating their food. Given the diversity of tastes, finding a universal right answer will be impossible. Nonetheless, debating contentious food topics around the dining table is still a fun activity where you get to see how fired up everyone gets.
Quick hits. Election 2024, October the 7th, is the last day to register to vote in the upcoming presidential election. A number of local races are also on the ballot. Eddie Mitchell will challenge current District 1 City Council person Mark Matta in November's election. Meals on Wheels Executive Director Craig Stoker is challenging incumbent Denise Swanner for the Odessa City Council at-large seat. Odessa Attorney Cal Hendrick is challenging Mayor Javier Hoven. District 2 will feature incumbent Steve Thompson against Nayeli Urias. The races are nonpartisan and are for four-year terms. October 7th is the last day to register to vote, and early voting begins October the 21st and ends November the 1st. November 5th is Election Day. ECRP Pancake Breakfast. The Ector County Republican Club has planned a First Responders Appreciation event with a pancake breakfast, 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. October 5th at the ECRP headquarters at 708 Jefferson Avenue. Veterans and first responders eat for free. Local candidates will be in attendance. There will be all-you-can-eat pancakes, bacon, fruit juice, and coffee for $10. Pumpkin Walk. Enjoy some holiday fun at the Bush Family Homes' first Pumpkin Walk. Imagine the Bush children decorating jack-o'-lanterns for Halloween back in the 1950s and join the fun by decorating your own and entering it in the Pumpkin Walk. Individuals, organizations, and businesses can bring their own decorated pumpkin between October the 24th, the 25th, or the 26th. Then on the evening of October 30th, between 5:30 to 7:30 p.m., everyone is invited to see the pumpkins and vote on their favorites. There are prizes for the winners. Pumpkins can be painted or carved. Obituaries. Charles David Chuck Teal, age 76, of McQueenie, Texas, passed away at his home on September the 16th. Virginia Bell Alexander, age 90, of Odessa, died Thursday, September the 5th, in Odessa. Chapel service will be held at 2 p.m. September the 21st at La Paz Chapel West at 7521 West University Boulevard in Odessa. Burial will follow on Monday, September the 23rd at 1 p.m. at Ector County Cemetery. Arrangements are by La Paz Funeral of Odessa. Blake Joshua Josh Williams, age 40, of Odessa, died Thursday, September 12th in Odessa. Chapel service will be held at 11 a.m. on September the 26th at Acres West Funeral Chapel. Dear Abby, I'm a single mother of two children, an 8-year-old daughter and a 9-year-old son. My daughter's father is involved. My son's father is not. I was diagnosed with pulmonary arterial hypertension, PAH, when my daughter was born and given 2 weeks to live. My condition has markedly improved, and I am on the best treatment there is for it. To safeguard my son in case something happens to me, my parents and I did a third-party adoption. With this new law, I was able to add my parents to my son's birth certificate without giving up my parental rights, and I remain the sole custodial parent. He stays with my parents 3 evenings a week. The problem is my mother blatantly favors my son over my daughter. Last year, she planned a Disney cruise for only herself, my son, and me. I understand life is not 100% fair, but her favoritism goes beyond just tickets and trips. It's everything from gifts and attention to tone of voice and how many pictures are on the wall. Everyone around us sees it, especially my daughter. Please advise. Dear Abby responds, I'll bet your daughter notices it. The person who can put a stop to it is you. Consult the attorney who helped you with the custody arrangement and explain that what has been happening is not healthy for either of your children. After you find out what your options are, including possibly changing the custody agreement, confront your mother about her blatant favoritism and be glad that your daughter's father is as responsible as he seems to be. Another Dear Abby. And another Dear Abby. I used to hang out with my friend Brian and his girlfriend Jenny. We all lived together and would spend almost every weekend together. They broke up and went their separate ways 14 years ago. Jenny is single, and Brian has a steady girlfriend now. I still talk to them both, but not often. Jenny messaged me recently on social media. We shared some photos and talked about the past and present. She said she has her own place and is doing well. I suggested that maybe I'd stop by one night after work. She said she'd like that and sent me her phone number to set up the date and time. My question is, should I visit her? And what if something sexual happens? Trust me, I wouldn't rule it out. Should I ask Brian for his permission? Are Jenny and I heartless for wanting to meet up? Dear Abby answers, because you are uneasy about crossing some kind of boundary if you visit Jenny and there is chemistry, contact Brian and say, hey, guess what? I reconnected with Jenny and she invited me over. Do you have any objection to that? I cannot see how, 14 years after their romance ended, he would have an objection. Then visit Jenny and que sera sera. And you can write to Dear Abby at www.dearabby.com or Post Office Box 69440, Los Angeles, California, 90069.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.